AshevilleFM.org, soon to be WSFM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursts. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay and KXCF in Marshall, California, as well as KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at our website at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and we can be reached at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's show is a recording of a presentation on the realities of prison for LGBTQQIA prisoners, as well as prison abolition. We apologize for the ambient noise levels during the presentation. This week's show was a recording of a presentation of the realities of prison for LGBTQQIA prisoners, as well as prison abolition. Again, we apologize for the ambient noise levels during this presentation. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll call like a boss! My security review. The silencing continues. This is Ivana Burnett reading a statement from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. I was approved to security level 4B in July of 2013 on pretextual rule violations because Gary Moore couldn't admit he was punishing me for exposing his cyber crimes. I arrived here at OSP in September. I suspected that I would be kept at level 4B on flimsy and transparent pretexts, no matter what I do. See, the real point is to keep me at high security long enough so I can't get to level 2, get programs, and earn a parole. So, final analysis, the parole board uses my misconduct and lack of programs to justify giving me 5 more years in prison. Yeah, I'll do 5 more years for tangling with Gary Moore. That'll teach me. As soon as I got here, I sent out kites. One went to Unit Management Administrator McDonough, asking if I could get lowered at my first 6-month review. Her answer, it will depend on a number of issues. Sick. Conduct report free. No STG activities. That's security threat group. Interaction with staff and other inmates. Programs completed, etc. Overall, you have to stay out of trouble and do positive things. Okay, 4 guidelines. Conduct free, no STG activity, interaction with others in programs. Easy enough, right? So, I stayed conduct free. I had no STG activities. My interactions with others are non-existent, since I'm locked in a shoebox. Totally isolated. And that left only programs. So I sent a kite to mental health programming. Their response, we'll add you to the wait list. Programs are very limited at this time. Please be patient. Thanks. And I sent a kite to my case manager, Mr. Nowak, asking for every program available. His response, I will place you on a waiting list for the unit-based programs based on your need and risk. I will have you start Money Smart in the month of September. So, I did all I could. On each round, when mental health or unit staff came to my cell, I asked for placement in programs. Nothing was available. The problem is, at 4B on constant lockdown, you cannot go to programming like 4A. And there are so many 4B prisoners, it is difficult to bring the programs to the prisoners. Thus, a waiting list. In a kite to Unit Manager Booth, I pointed out I had signed up for every program I'm eligible to take. Unit Manager Booth had been replaced. Unit Manager Wolf responded by telling me to address these issues with my case manager, Mr. Nowak. So, in another kite, I did. Recall the criteria Ms. McDonough had given me for getting lowered. Conduct report free, which I did. STG activity free. No negative interactions, which I met, and programs, which I signed up for. I went into security review with Unit Manager Wolf and Case Manager Nowak. Points raised. 1. I wasn't guilty of the rule violations that were the pretext for sending me to 4B. I presented the sworn affidavit of Les Dillon, monkey number 9. 2. I was supposed to go to level 2, until the 12 monkeys frame up. 3. I see the parole board in 2016 and cannot meet the conditions they set for me to go to level 2 to get programming, unless I am lowered in security each available time I come up for review. 4. The rule violations are non-violent. 5. I met all criteria Ms. McDonough had described. 6. My security instrument for getting me to 4B indicated that I should have been left at 3B in the first place. And 7. Sean Marshall, who admitted to doing what I was falsely accused of doing, was sent to 4B after me and was already dropped to 4A. So, collectively, I demonstrated that I was innocent, should have been sent to level 2, at worst should have stayed at level 3, and that another prisoner who did what I was accused of went to 4B and was dropped to 4A. So, refusing to drop me would obviously be singling me out, because the real reason I'm here is so that Gary Moore can teach me my place for exposing his crimes. They decided to keep me at 4B. Their reasoning? No programming. Seriousness of placement offense. Inmate was found guilty of being a co-creator of an STG group, 12 Monkeys. Let's address these three rationale. No programming. Since I'm at 4B where I can't get programs, I have to stay at 4B until I get the programs I can't get at 4B. In other words, more of the problem is the solution of the problem. They will continue to punish me for their incompetence until, well, forever, it seems. Seriousness of placement offense. The things I provably did not do are serious enough to keep me at 4B, which means I never really had a shot to get lowered at 6 months because the offense is the offense, and I arrived with it. Except Marshall, at 4A, was found guilty too. Inmate was found guilty of being a co-creator of an STG group, 12 Monkeys. The reason they put this on there was to distinguish between Marshall and me. Marshall, who admits he is monkey number 10 of the 12 Monkeys. Problem is, they made this up. Nowhere in my contact report does it say I was the co-creator of anything. Nobody cares. Clearly, I'm going to remain at 4B indefinitely. In the next six months, I'll get a large number of ridiculous conduct reports for conduct that doesn't constitute misconduct to justify keeping me here. I could hide under my bunk for 6 months. This has been a message from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain at the Supermax facility OSP. If you can't hear the sound of his voice, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
My name is Adrian. I've been working with Transmission for 3 or 4 years now. I'm Gray. I've been with Transmission about 5.
I'm Bernard, and I've been working with Transmission on and off for about 2 years.
So Transmission Prison Project we're a small radical group that works out of Asheville. Our focus is to support lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, etc. Incarcerated people. We support folks through correspondence. We support folks who are incarcerated nationwide. We're one of the only organizations that does that. And we come from a radical prison abolitionist mindset, but the work we do isn't specifically prison abolition work. It's support work, but pretty much everyone involved. So the ways in which we support folks are the main thing at this point that we focus on is sending books to folks who are incarcerated. We also for many years had a pen pal program that we are now kind of taking a step away from. The amount of mail we get has increased like 100-fold over the last 5 years. So we send books to folks. We help get them connected with like resources and information. We send out these things that are called National Prisoner Resource Lists that list other organizations that do various things like what we do. You know, if someone wants us to look something up, we look things up for people. Some of us still do continue to like have pen pals, but we just don't really have a pen pal program anymore. And most of the work is just to like, yeah, help folks who are incarcerated feel less isolated and objectified. And so this workshop, yeah, is going to be about, you know, information we know from the work that we do about the specific like issues that folks that are queer and trans in prison face, and why prison is not, why would prison abolitionists, I guess. And but it's not a trans 101. We will be using language that has to do with, like, you know, using words like transgender and cisgender and things like that. If we ever are saying something or using words that y'all don't understand, feel free to, like, stop us and ask us to clarify. There's also the handout that some of y'all grabbed that has definitions on it. You can glance at that. Most of the language we'll be using was defined there. Some of those handouts, like most of our stuff, needs to be updated or is poorly copied, but we're pretty strapped for resources and time, so it is what it is.
On all of the resources that we have, be it money or books or person power, is all a donation based, or like people donate their time. We hold fundraisers. We're not even a nonprofit. We're not a 501c3. We don't get any sort of government support at all, which is sort of how we want to keep it, as like prison is an offshoot of the government, which I feel confident in saying that we feel that both of those things are bad things. And like, just to maybe talk about prison a little bit, I'm sorry if this is not new information to anybody, but we like to go over how prisons fuck people over usually. And we're against mass imprisonment and the prison industrial complex for many different reasons, and some of those are that it tends to alienate people. It rips them from their homes, their communities, their families, their systems of support, and that is what it does. That's what it's designed to do. It's designed to alienate and isolate and denigrate people. It's a system of punishment that doesn't give anything back to anybody. So for example, there's no education training. There's no, I mean, you have to fight for that stuff if you want education training in prison. If you want to get your GED, or if you want to take classes, or if you need any sort of support from, it's just a holding pen, basically. It's not any kind of solution to any sort of behavior that might be considered antisocial at all. It reduces people to statistics and numbers, and we probably all know, like, from our lives that that's not a productive thing to do if you at all want to interface with their humanity. More than 2 million people in this country are imprisoned at this moment, which is, I think, the highest percent of the population of any country in the world is imprisoned.
Larger than many countries.
What's that?
And larger than many countries.
Yeah, larger than many countries. And I mean, we're one of the highest rates of putting people in cages. There are systems of abuse in prison, like there are systems of abuse in society, but from all reports, they seem to be magnified in prison. So mental, physical, emotional, sexual. Oh, just to also step back for a second, we're going to be talking about some potentially triggering topics. And if you do not want to hear about that, no worries. I understand. Please do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself. To get back to it. Sexual abuse. Guards and other inmates, like, consider this sort of thing part of the business, and also it is very common for corrections officers or COs to pit incarcerated people against each other. So for example, if someone on your hall does something that's considered to be bad, everybody on the hall gets punished. Like, everybody on the hall gets sent to lockdown or gets their meals curtailed or something. It's not unilateral. It's definitely a multilateral system of punishment in prison.
Lockdown is everyone has to stay in their cells for 24 hours a day.
Yeah, solitary confinement. We'll get more to that later. And there are high, as there are in society, there's high instances of sexual assault in prison. 1 in 10 people that the state thinks are men report sexual assault in prison. There's no stats for trans people, though. And in women's prison, the statistics are very much higher. And actually, the population of people in women's prison is one of the fastest growing populations right now. There was a study recently that stated the rate of incarceration, or like the number of people of who are incarcerated in women's prison, has gone up around 800% in the last 7 years or so. And in that same time, the rate of incarceration in men's prison went up by 100%. So you can just imagine that level of incarceration. Also, the like so-called justice system has shown itself time and time again, and will probably until it collapses, hopefully, to be biased against poor people, people of color, and queer communities, and, you know, also just any marginalized community that you can think of. That includes political marginalization. Quality of life is very, very curtailed for people. You're not really free to move about as you might like to. You're not really allowed to go outside except for very circumscribed times of the day. There's little to no privacy. People generally have to sleep many to a room in bunk beds, usually, unless you're in solitary confinement. You're not really allowed to explore like creative endeavors that you might want to. You're not really allowed to read what you might want to. The food is really, really bad, and a lot of times people's food allergies or like food choices, like veganism, for example, would not fly in prison. People aren't really going to respect that either dietary need or food choice that people have.
I had one of my pen pals had Crohn's disease and died because he couldn't have proper access to healthcare for that disease.
Many, many people contract diabetes. Many, many people contract chronic like heart conditions because of poor nutrition. Also, you have to pay for everything in prison. Like, you are not... Nothing is given to you. So stamps, envelopes, paper, hygiene products, clothes, shoes, like soap and shampoo and stuff like that. You're not... Toothbrushes. People, they don't just give it to you. You have to pay for it. And people have what's called commissaries, which is basically their, like, prison bank account, almost. So if you ever hear of somebody being like, we're raising money for this person's commissary, like, that's what they're doing. Also, prisons are rapidly being more and more privatized. So, I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, like, what that means is they are being controlled by private companies and not by government agencies, which, like, everybody in prison, in a privatized prison, they get a certain dollar amount for that person, so people compete to have more and more people in their prison so that they get more and more government funding, mm-hmm. which are, like, capitalism and the prison system just, like, are meshing in really bad ways.
Yeah, in privatized prisons, they get paid per head. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the thing that's really horrific about how quickly most prisons are privatizing now is that the companies they're contractors, it's private contracting that does it, and then they get paid by the government for however many people they have in there. So they want to, one, get as many people incarcerated as possible, and they want to keep people there. And so there's a lot of things that ways that people hypothetically can get their sentences shortened for like good behavior. Good behavior rules are really, really, really strict, and there's a lot of things that can happen when someone's in prison that will extend their original sentence. So there's ways hypothetically to shorten your sentence, and there's ways that your sentence gets extended. Things that can happen that can get your sentence extended are like a lot, and if guards are being like harassing you or being abusive to you at all, then like, and you respond to that, extend your sentence and whatever, and that's even more of a problem in like privatized situations, because what they want to do is just keep as many people in there as long as possible. It also ties into the, like, no, services being cut so much because, one, they cost money, and two,
rehabilitation isn't a goal if it's a privatized prison, or ever, but especially in privatized prison systems, because recidivism is like financially beneficial, which recidivism is once someone's been incarcerated, they're more likely to be incarcerated again. And so if someone is like incarcerated, I'm getting off on a tangent. If someone's, is arrested and imprisoned for something and then, you know, like eventually released, they come out into the world without much assistance. And a lot of times, like, you know, a whole other animal that we're not going to get into too much in this workshop is like they're barred from pretty much all benefits from the government, can't get most jobs and stuff like that. And so often end up having to, resort to like illegal ways of making money and then end up back in prison, or like parole rules are really strict and whatever. You know, there's like all these things that people end up back in prison quite often more than once. And that's beneficial to the prison system, especially in a privatized system, because those companies are just going to make more money off of people. Because also it's people in prison do work and you don't have to pay you people really anything at all. Like, you know, I mean, get like under 50 cents an hour, like 12 cents an hour or something for the labor that they do. And I think that, were you going to talk, is that
and people,
something that we're talking
people
about
in prison, it does bear mentioning that people in prison who are forced to work, people run the prison, basically. Any kind of maintenance, any cleaning, any like cooking, any sort of, people who are in prison basically run the workings of the prison. And that does not extend to any like administrative duties or like guard duties or anything like that. But I know that people were experimenting in California recently with going on work strike to get their needs met, and that has, you know, is a tactic that works varyingly well. But yeah, I mean, Wells Fargo is one of the largest investors in privatizing prisons, so something that to bear in mind, or whatever, you know. Voting with your dollar is a dubious political action, but it can be nice to know.
Victoria's Secret also does a lot. There's a lot of computer and car stuff that's made in prisons. It's a newer thing, kind of semi-newer, is telemarketing. Another thing, like, why we're prison kind of related to all of these things and to what I was saying earlier about that, like, we come from, like, a prison abolitionist framework, is that an important thing that I read once, Are Prisons Obsolete? A book by Angela Davis is a really good book to read about. It's a little out of date, not that the information is still really pertinent, but the book is like 10 years old, but it's still, so some of the statistics, I guess, are out of date. But she talks about in that a lot about, you know, reform versus abolition, and that like the birth of the prison system that we currently have was the result of prison reform. And I think that like when thinking of reform versus abolition, for me, that's a really important thing to keep in mind, along with all these other things, that it's just absolutely not about like, social safety or anything that it like pretends to be about. But even in like, yeah, that idea of like, well, we could change it, make it better, that's like not, one, it's not going to happen, and two, it's like, that's a dangerous road to go down, because this prison system was born due to pretty adamant reform movements and is horrific. So,
and for all these reasons, you may have heard the term political prisoner. For all these reasons and many, many more, like, I personally, and I think Transmission as a group, believes that all prisoners are political, and there is not a reason that somebody goes to prison that is not in some way political. And we also believe that the term political prisoner is slightly divisive in many ways and creates a hierarchy of the deserving and the non-deserving prisoner, which I think is not really helpful. There are vastly differing opinions about that term, too, which is an entirely different workshop, I think. But
well, first, okay, I'm going to go over this two-sided worksheet or whatever, flow chart, if you will. I'm starting on the poverty and homelessness side. I think this was put out by the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And it's just kind of like
it shows how systems of inequality make higher instances of create higher instances of poverty and homelessness in trans and gender nonconforming communities and folks, and then how that then on the other side results in higher instances of incarceration. So it starts a lot of folks who are trans and gender nonconforming are stuck in like low income jobs or can't get jobs, and that's due to discrimination in hiring practice. It's due to lack of access to benefits and lack of access to good employment. And this talks a lot about like because folks' IDs don't match their gender identity, which for folks that are going like incognito is like a specific problem, but even for folks who are like out as trans, like aside from ID stuff, it's hard for out trans people to find work that's safe, even if one would get hired, to like not be harassed at work by coworkers, or if they're in a job where they're interacting with the public, by the public. And then there's most cities, institutions, and states and whatever don't protect. You can not hire someone due to their gender identity, and you can fire them due to their gender identity. I think, like, you know, there's some cities that's protected, like maybe Seattle, right?
Yeah, most states in the U.S. are what's called right-to-work states.
There's that.
Which means you can basically get fired at any time for any reason, or no reason at all.
Finding gainful and safe employment is really hard for gender non-conforming and trans folks, and which is, you know, and for similar reasons, you know, they have less access to like higher education, and a lot of, or if they even graduated from high school, trans folks are more likely one of the populations that's more likely to drop out of high school because of like harassment and unsafe school environment. I think it's even, you know, even like gay kids are a bit higher than like straight kids as far as I understand the statistics. And then some trans folks can't get access to higher education, again, because of if they're incognito, because of, you know, identification inconsistencies, and if they're out due to, like, discrimination.
Question. Mm-hmm. What does incognito mean?
It means that someone, another way that, like, folks who can pass as cisgender in the world, as non-trans, and will so be living stealth, I guess is another way to put it, that are trans but are not out in either all or most or parts of their life as trans, but are exist as the identity that they are, but without the trans being known. So for there's a lot higher instance of homelessness in trans, especially trans youth populations. A lot of folks are kicked out of their house if they come out in when they're teenagers, and they don't have a lot of housing, and programs, assistance programs, are divided by binary gender. And so folks that are trans don't have access to that housing, or have to pretend that they're not trans. And there are certain trans folks that can't do that for various reasons. And this is also a problem for trans folks coming out of prison, too, is that there's like halfway houses are divided by gender, or by binary gender. And so there's a lot of, we get letters from folks that are looking for like queer and trans friendly assistance coming out of prison, and it just doesn't really exist in most places. So that's like, yeah, a problem that can lead to incarceration, and then it is a problem after one is like incarcerated. And trans folks also have inadequate or no health care, because the mainstream health practitioners tend to be incredibly transphobic. That's changing in some areas. Here, there's Western North Carolina Community Health Services is really helpful, but a lot of trans folks won't seek necessary health care because it's pretty dangerous and discriminatory. And so all of these kind of, you know, create this perfect storm of awful. So then the other side is how systems of inequality relate to the criminal justice system. Trans women sometimes are arrested for doing sex work, for being out on the street at night when they're not necessarily, that's not necessarily what they're doing.
That just happened with a woman in Tucson named Monica Jones, who is a student of social work and also a sex worker, right? She works with the Sex Worker Outreach Project in Tucson, or SWAP, and she got arrested for basically walking while trans and spoke to an undercover police officer and got arrested for solicitation. Or, like, solicitation with the intent to, like,
the intent for prostitution, which was like clearly not true, and even if it was, like, is not you know, not a reason to detain someone. She just got convicted and is going to appeal very, very soon, and there's fundraisers for her around the country. She also happens to be a trans woman who also happens to be Black. And people are who fall into that gender and race intersection are extremely discriminated against systematically.
Other ways that it says on here that that trans folks are criminalized is for using the wrong bathroom and having, like, lacking proper identification or having identifications that don't match, because depending on what it is, you know, some stuff is easier to get changed than other as far as papers go. And when one does change their legal name and or is allowed by the state to change their gender identity, you have to do, like, pretty much every different document individually. And it is incredibly expensive and a huge pain in the ass. And also, on the other side of this, criminalization of poor and homeless people, there's people who are homeless especially, but also poor, profiled and harassed by police more often. And, you know, if one is living outside, you just have more exposure to police, and or police have more exposure to you, or access to you, I guess, I think. A lot of folks who are poor, homeless, and trans folks have to resort to survival crimes, which is like, you know, sex work, dealing drugs, theft, etc., to make ends meet, and are charged with quality of life crimes, which is sleeping outdoors and doing other things to get stuff for your not being having somewhere inside to go. So low-income trans people are exposed to arrest, police harassment, incarceration, and violence far more than the average person. And as Adrian said, I think, yeah, 30% of trans women are incarcerated, which is three times the national average for other populations. And so once trans folks and gender nonconforming folks, and even and like gay and bisexual and lesbian folks, are once they're incarcerated, they're subject to more harassment as well. Trans folks specifically are and from the folks we correspond with, a lot of gay men too. I don't remember the statistic, but if one is, I think, queer about in about any capacity when incarcerated, they have a lot higher risk of sexual harassment and sexual assault than other populations in prison do. I mean, all folks who are incarcerated, I think, are like at a special risk of that, but folks that are out as gay and out as trans are at a much higher risk. They are, trans folks in particular, are denied access to hormones in most prisons once they enter, and that can be, I mean, that's awful in and of itself, but being taken off of a regular dose of hormones and kind of going like cold turkey is really harmful and can be just really like traumatizing for one's body and mind. And there are folks have been really fighting for that right to have access to their, because like folks who are already on hormones will in most cases get them taken away and can't continue to be on hormone treatment. Folks who are incarcerated and want to go on hormones can't go on hormones. That's a thing that I know a lot of trans women in particular that we correspond with have been fighting for. And in Texas, I think they got the law changed so that they can have access, continue to have access to their hormone treatment for the most part. I don't know if they can get access if they don't have it yet. I think that might be a prison by prison.
A lot of times people, if they have an existing prescription for hormones, are, the rules say that they are entitled to have those hormones. Like if they had an existing prescription, a legal one, then they can continue that into their incarceration. 9 times out of 10, it doesn't really work that way. And if people want to continue their hormones in prison, which like a lot of times people need hella outside support to do that. Like when Cece McDonald was incarcerated, I don't know if you're familiar with her case, but she had people fighting for her right to take her hormone prescription on the outside, very, very many people. And a lot of times, due to like some of the things that Gray mentioned on that worksheet, people just don't have outside support. We get so many letters of people being like, you're the only ones I talk to. I don't have anybody. My family disowned me, or they are all dead, or something like that. And so people, you know, get isolated and don't have the kinds of support that they need.
And not having outside contact, but so the guards know
who gets mail and who doesn't. You know, like all the people in administration in the prison, you know, they like know who gets mail and who doesn't. And people who guards know aren't getting mail are more subject to harassment than folks who aren't. If the guards know that someone has folks on the outside, they're less likely to be severely harassed than folks who have no outside contact, which is kind of this like twofold awful, you know, like not only are you in, you know, whatever other things, incarcerated and have no one on the outside, you're also in more danger if you have, if you're not getting any mail. One other thing is with, for trans folks, are placed in prison according to genitalia, not according to any other kind of transition or like even necessarily what their IDs say. So trans women, unless they have had bottom surgery or whatever you want to call it, are placed in men's prisons. And so, and most, so there's, and even, you know, if they have like been on hormones forever and have implants and have, you know, like appear as what most, you know, even like cis sexist people would consider women, they still have to be in a men's prison. And so that's especially dangerous. So LGBTQI folks who are incarcerated are at risk for more violence from guards and other inmates, and a lot of times are therefore put in solitary confinement, sometimes as kind of a weird like punishment thing, sometimes for their own safety. There's also some prisons have like have started creating like special units for out queer folks, like, and so I think, which can be helpful, I think, in some ways for folks, but also makes them like a pretty easy just like group for the guards to target, and makes it easier for them to just kind of isolate the whole unit. And there have been some stuff, like there's a unit in a prison in California that has a lot of it's folks that are mostly queer or trans or folks with disabilities. Like, I know there was at least one man, and then there was like a blind man who was being treated really poorly. But anyway, we got letters from people in this facility that were like, everyone here is being abused so severely, will you please help us? Because it was just like this unit that had like all folks that were at higher risk kind of all together, kind of isolated. And so there's not really, I mean, there's not really any real safety for anyone who's incarcerated, but especially like out queer and trans folks. And there was a gay male that I was writing who would stand up for himself. People would beat him up because he was gay, and he would fight back, and he would get thrown in the hole, which is solitary confinement, and he would be in there for like years, and then he'd come out and immediately someone would like be homophobic to him and he'd get in a fight, and then he'd be thrown back in the hole for a year. And like, so solitary confinement is a thing that is, yeah, there's a high instance of folks who are trans and queer in that. And
so we've been talking about solitary confinement a lot, and just to like, I don't know, go over what that is, because that's a pretty real consideration that everybody in prison goes through, no matter kind of who you are. There's a very real risk that you're going to be thrown into solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is considered by many countries to be torture, because human beings are social animals, and we don't really benefit, for the most part, from being isolated from other people. Solitary confinement is also called protective custody. Sometimes people call it lockdown or the hole. And if you ever see a prisoner write to you and they have the words, the letters SHU, that means special housing unit, and that's also solitary confinement. People are alone about 23 to 23.5 hours a day. And people are granted, or are supposed to be granted, 1 hour of outside time, which means you get to stand outside in a fence that's about as big as your cell. And in solitary confinement cells, it's about as big as a, like, fairly small bathroom. There's a bed and a toilet, sometimes a mirror, and that's basically it. That's all that's really in your room. Some people have desks. Some people have TVs, like little tiny TVs that they can use. And it really depends, like, but it's usually like a fairly severely small room, severely curtailed amenities.
Yeah, like maybe the size of this circle.
Or smaller.
Yeah, like yeah. The inside of this circle.
When you're incarcerated in a federal prison, while you're being processed, and when you first get there, you go in the SHU right away. Like, you start out in solitary for the first, like, can be anywhere from, like, 2 days to 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
depending on when. So if you're...
I didn't know that.
When you go in when you're being checked into a federal prison, you start out in the shoe always. Everybody's always been there. Everybody always knows.
Yeah.
It feels like. So
that's a consideration as well. It's used for discipline. It's also used, a lot of trans people or queer people have elected to go into the SHU because they feel so unsafe in general population that they're just like, well, isolation's got to be better. But in isolation, you're still exposed to prison guards.
And some, not all SHU units are, like some of them, it's you're like in a room and it just has like a whatever, like a door with just a little window. And but there's some that are like, there'll be like a line of them and you're in a room, a small room by yourself all the time, but there's a big window so everyone can just stare at you all
the time. Yeah, a big glass wall.
So you have like no access to people, but they can like, yeah.
But they can like gawk at you. Get way less access to phone calls than you would if you were in general population. Sometimes you get TVs. Like there was somebody who just passed away named Herman Wallace who was in solitary for 40 years and he had a TV, I think. A little tiny one. But I mean, what, he was in solitary for 40 years. That's more time than many or probably all of us have been alive. And in other countries, I think that Norway has some sort of law that you cannot be in solitary confinement for more than 72 hours. And the average time that people are in solitary confinement in this country is 5 years. Solitary confinement is, like we said, bad for people. There is, I think it might be in the DSM, I'm not entirely, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, which like catalogs so-called mental disorders, has a special housing unit syndrome in it now, which people get if they're in solitary confinement for prolonged, extensive periods of time. And some symptoms of special housing unit syndrome are sensitivity to noise, lack of recognition of colors, paranoia, lack of ability to formulate words and sentences. It just fucking ruins people. It fucking ruins people. And also prison. Like, there was a study in prison in general, not in solitary confinement specifically, but people's brains change irrevocably if they're in prison for more than 3 years. Your brain changes. You can't go back. So that is something. And you know, prison sucks for everyone, not just for LGBTQ people. LGBTQ people are the population that transmission writes to, but there are very many prison books all across the country that write to everyone or who send stuff to everyone, and it is just a very, very bad thing, and people need to feel supported because people are at their best when they feel supported. Do y'all have any questions about anything we were saying or any comments? Or
does Asheville have a prison books that's not you guys?
Yes, there's Asheville prison books.
Okay.
And we share a space, so like they have a different mailing address. They like try to support a different population than we do, and they send stuff to basically everybody
in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Tennessee.
That's right. And transmission, incidentally, is on some sort of blacklist for North Carolina, so we can't actually send to anybody in North Carolina. So when we get a letter from somebody incarcerated in Raleigh, for example, we have to send them using the Asheville prison books stuff, which is, it gets to them fine, but we just can't send under the auspices of transmission.
That wasn't always the case. That was like in the last few years they have blocked us or put us on a list where we're not allowed.
And people who are incarcerated in the state of Louisiana cannot get mail from anywhere outside of state. So there's a pretty great need. Yeah, that's a really recent thing.
That.
Yeah.
So we just, if we send people an "I'm sorry, we can't send to you" letter, it will not get to them, unless we relay it through another organization or another group of people.
Can you all send books to folks in state and federal prisons, or just individuals?
Yeah. Yeah.
We send to mostly state and federal prisons. It's not. Okay. It's. Okay. Jails are pretty rare because people don't stay in them long enough for us to actually get around it.
We're about 6 months behind on our correspondence, so like if somebody in jail sends us something, we're not going to see it, unfortunately.
And another thing, just to go back to, when people are in lockdown or in protective custody, not all places, but in some places, they have no access to the library when they're
locked down or in solitary. Sometimes they can't receive mail at all, but that varies. Like a lot of things, it varies from prison to prison, but we definitely get letters from folks who are in solitary and also can't even access the library and only get like the books that we send them once a year.
In prison, there's something that's called a mail room, and people's mail can be held very, very long in the mail room, depending on who's working that day or if the person is, I don't know. People's mail has been held up to a year.
Yeah, we got mail returned to us that had been held for a year before it was returned to us.
And that's a form of intimidation, right? Like, guards are just like, well, we're not going to let this person connect with anybody on the inside or the outside, and like, we're just going to hold this person's mail. And that's a fairly common intimidation tactic that people employ. So, like, we've been talking a lot about really horrifying fish, and it's, I guess, nice to, like, think a little bit about, at the end of these things, to, like, think about what you can do, like, how to help, how to interface with, like, a sick society with a prison industrial complex in it. And I think that one of the main things to, like, keep in mind as, like, allies on the outside is to just talk to people about prison and about, like, things you're thinking about, things that you hear, any solutions within, like, intentional communities, perhaps, of, like, solutions to the justice system or, like, how people can hold each other accountable without a police state and without a prison industrial complex. To not get freaked out about this thing, like, any more than is kind of, like, normal. And to not let all of this information have a chilling effect on you. I think it's really, really important to be like, all of this stuff exists, and I'm still a human being. I still have myself, you know, and I'm gonna, like, interface with this in whatever way is normal for me or, like, feels good to do so. Or, like, not at all. I mean, a lot of people don't think about this stuff at all, which is, you know, people's choice or whatever, but I think that it's really good to keep in mind that this stuff exists and to not let it chill you out of doing anything about it.
Yeah, I have a story and a comment. A couple of years ago, I was interviewing this guy in prison in Wisconsin. He was an animal rights activist. I think he got like 5 years.
Word.
And after a couple messages that he would send us, like a couple months apart, I started to realize that I just didn't know what to talk about or what to say. And now this semester, in my philosophy class, we read a piece by Stephen Dillon called The Only Freedom I See.
Mm.
And it's basically about queer writing and the politics of the unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's kind of arguing is that, like, especially for people in prison and the, like, in the whole, that just how are they supposed to articulate what they experience and how are you supposed to understand their experience? And then the other way around, too, like, how am I supposed to explain to them what it feels like to go to, like, visit a cow or just to be outside. And there's a tension between that.
Mm.
And I think one of the main points that he wanted to make was that a lot of people just assume that we know what people in prison need. And his stance is, like, instead of going to that, just asking them, like, how can I help you? Like, you're in there and I'm here and we're in completely different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Worlds that are just, like, completely unimaginable for the both of us. And just, like, that definitely worked for me, kind of, like, understanding, like, instead of assuming I know what you need, you probably need these things, and being like, hey, how can I help you? And sometimes they have difficulty answering that question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a really, really interesting tension there.
Or, like, what they need is to not be in prison, you know, and sometimes, like, individuals can't make that happen. Unless they're lawyers or unless they're judges or whatever, but just being like, hey, I just need to hear from you. Yeah, I've written to a lot of people that are just like, I just need to hear from you. I just need to know that you're there.
Yeah.
The amount of, when I started, like, the stack of mail that we would get each week was about this big. And now the stack of mail that we get each week is this big. And there's less of us now than when I started. And so, but one of the purposes originally for us, and I think we still try to do and maybe don't, are unable to do as gracefully as we did in the past, is ask the people that write to us what they want our support to look like, and try to base what we do as an organization on that, not on what we assume they might need when they're incarcerated. And
Now that's a problem because mostly what people want is pen pals, and something that we can't give them is pen pals. So it's been a practice in learning to say no, having to say no when you don't want to say no a lot. But I think, yeah, that is a really important point to, like, ask folks that you're, like, connected with in some way or incarcerated what they need or want. Or, like, and, like, when I write my pen pals, we, like, our old pen pal forms had, like, people would list interests, and so I would find people based on, like, okay, we have a few common interests, and then just ask them weird questions and would let the, you know, each individual that I was writing kind of base my correspondence on how, what kind of interactions they initiated. Like, some people don't write me very much, just send me, like, a card every once in a while, and but I know they like poetry, and if I find a poem I like, I'll send it to them or something. And then there's other people that I'm writing, you know, are writing, like, pages of letters, you know, once a month or something, and so it's different for every person. But yeah, I think that is a really important point.
Just to follow up, that I find with most people I know who've never written to somebody who's incarcerated, the thing that is stopping them the most is being like, well, I don't know what I would write. And, like, that's understandable, but seriously, write anything. If that's, like, if you're like, oh, I don't know what, like, write about the time when you were 5 and you spilled some milk and somebody got, like, really mad at you. Like, it totally doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It matters to some extent, but, like, writing absolutely anything to somebody who's incarcerated is, like, incredibly valuable. And maybe it's not exactly what that person wanted to hear, but, like, it is, like, so, so much better than letting that anxiety stop you from writing to somebody.
Yeah. Well, and I found that sometimes when, yeah, like, especially with some of my pen pals, the initial letter, when I'd be like, oh, I don't know this person at all, what am I going to write? I will ask the weirdest, most random questions, like, if you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go? Here's where I would go. Yeah. Or, like, what's your favorite plant? Or, like, just weird, random stuff that I'm just like, I'm going to act like I'm 13 and writing some weird pen pal letter or something.
Totally.
And if people are, like, weirded out by it, the folks that I've written that have been like, that, I don't know what to say, like, you're kind of weird, we'll just tell you. You know, like, social grace isn't so necessary when one is, like, corresponding in this way. Oh, and another thing that, like, adding to a little off topic, but what Adrian was saying before, and, like, ways to be, something to do with, like, this information and wanting to be, I don't know, supportive in whatever ways, is, like, remember that what the media says about prisoners in prisons is absolutely false. Like, across the board, what TV shows and movies, the ways that they present prisons and incarcerated folks and all of that is absolutely false. Just like, even, and I've never seen Orange is the New Black. I refuse to see it. A lot of people think that it's, like, close to reality because it's based on some book that someone wrote who was incarcerated. That's off. It's not. Because it wouldn't be freaking funny if it were. Yeah. It would not. It wouldn't be allowed on TV. It would be an X-rated movie, and no one would want to see it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, it is not amusing. And, like, while people, yeah, sure, like, have love and have relationships and have interactions and, I'm sure, laugh and do whatever when they're in prisons and jails and all of that, it's not funny to watch. And if someone's being entertained by it in that way, and if it's, like, money-making in the way that any show or movie needs to be, it's not real. And it's based on, like, a social idea that has to be maintained in order for prisons to be maintained. Incarcerated folks are not scary, serial murder, rapist, whatever. Like, there are folks that do that stuff in prison. They are a tiny, 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 tiny percent of that population. And it's, yeah, it's mostly folks who, most of whom are, like, stuck in various systems of oppression that resulted in them being incarcerated, you know, like, and...
Or who are in there for, like, what might be considered non-violent survival-related activities, like dealing weed or doing sex work or being trans or shoplifting too many times or like
money laundering, scamming, writing bad checks,
scamming food stamps, you know, all that ish, you know.
The highest percent of reasons that people are incarcerated is economic crimes are the highest instance of incarceration. I think after that it's drugs. Like what the media and news and movies and TV and whatever say about prisoners, like folks who are incarcerated and prisons, is false. And like remembering that, learning more about like what those what really contributes to that and what that experience is really like, and talking about that as much as you like can or feel comfortable doing, I think helps make a difference.
Also, there's ways to like support this particular group if you feel like you want to. if you feel like taking on a pen pal, even though we don't really do that anymore, there's a list of 500 people who are would love to write to anyone. We also, like I said, we're a donation-based group, so if there's old books that you don't want anymore...
Not textbooks.
Usually not hardcover books. We can't really send those in, or they don't really get accepted in a lot of places. That would be awesome. If you have the energy to throw us a fundraiser, that would be really cool. We show up with zines and help out. Or if you feel like coming to packing nights, which for me and Gray is every Wednesday night at around 5 p.m., and for Bernard is a little different.
Tuesdays and Thursdays from 3 to 5.
And we meet in downtown, or in the Montford area, like near downtown Asheville, and we can like give contact information for directions or anything like that. Yeah, and or like volunteer in a prison library if you want to do that. A book out from AK Press last year called Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment in the Prison Industrial Complex. It's a collection of essays, and there's a bunch of like really awesome history in there. There's a lot of people's just direct experience with police and the prison system. It's edited by Eric Stanley, who's an anarchist, but not all of the essays in there are from an anarchist perspective, if that's not your thing. It's really accessible, extremely well written, very variegated, and I really recommend it. I've enjoyed it a lot.
And then there's Victoria Law.
Yeah.
What is women?
Resistance Behind Bars,
yes.
I think.
Yeah, there's zines by her, and then that also, I think she turned it into a book. And then there was one other one I thought of. Oh, 13 Women. It's also about, it's different stories collected by these two women that were, I think, working in prisons in the 70s and 80s, and they collected, like, the stories of these 13 different incarcerated women about, like, what led to their incarceration, their experience with it, and a lot of them that were out their life after. And it's, like, some of it's, like, stuff that the women wrote on their own, some of it's interviews, all of that. It's really good.
Slightly related. A lot is maybe a stretch, but there are at least a handful of like rad and anarchist folks and writers and artists who will send their stuff to prisons for free. And I don't know if there's like a comprehensive list of that somewhere, but like Ben Passmore sends his books to prisons for free.
I met some awesome people in prison. There's just some of the like best people, and just the letters that I've exchanged with people are really special and extremely, like, I mean, there's also ishheads everywhere, you know? There's also ishheads who are like, I'm gonna push your buttons and be a dick to you and, like, disrespect your gender identity or say weird shit to you over letters. But you know what? Like, there's some awesome people. And, like, it's a society like anywhere else, you know?
So. A really brutal movie to watch about trans women in prison that is here somewhere. Some group on campus has it. It's called Cruel Unusual, is that what it's called? Yeah. It's about a lot of what we just talked about, but a movie, it follows the stories of, I think, four women.
Mm-hmm.
It relates pretty directly to like the work that we do, and it's brutal for me to watch.
I also want to mention, since we are not doing the Pen Pal program anymore, that Black and Pink is an organization that's based out of Boston, I think, who does still have a pretty extensive catalog of folks on their website, which I think is blackandpink.org, of folks who are incarcerated looking for pen pals. They also do a monthly newsletter that is free for incarcerated LGBTQ folks, and if you are not incarcerated, you can still get it for a small fee, and the fee that you pay goes to like send more copies to folks who are incarcerated, so that's rad.
This week's show was a recording of a presentation of the realities of prison for LGBTQIA prisoners, as well as prison abolition. AshevilleFM.org, soon to be WSFM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursts. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay and KXCF in Marshall, California, as well as KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at our website at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and we can be reached at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's show is a recording of a presentation on the realities of prison for LGBTQQIA.